Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and earned a BS in General Studies from the University of Michigan. From 1985 to 1997, he was the founder and CEO of Amstaff, a PEO, and since 2002, he's been the chairman and CEO of Access Point. Access Point is a professional employer organization and human resources company. His name? Greg Packer, and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Greg Packer, the chairman and CEO of Access Point. Greg, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. Great to see you as well.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Sure. That's a long time ago. I got to dig deep into the memory banks. But I grew up in Detroit, and it was interesting as I go back to the old neighborhood. It's referred to as Brightmoor, the Brightmoor district. It's not one of the more well-heeled neighborhoods today. But it was a great neighborhood to grow up in for me. I didn't realize the things that were missing in my life. I raised my kids in Birmingham, Michigan. It's quite a different upbringing, but it was a terrific life. Had lots of fun. Mom and Dad were great. My dad worked for a relatively large company. Lost his job when I was in about seventh or eighth grade. So we went through the family trauma of that. They did all they could to mitigate the impact on us. So it was a great childhood. Went to Bird Elementary School and Redford High School through ninth grade. So I was proud to be a Detroiter.
What's the biggest thing you learned from Mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Dad?
I would definitely say hard work and perseverance. Overcoming obstacles. My mom was always very much sort of the rock. She couldn't overreact because my dad didn't always handle unexpected curveballs, so to speak. Well, he needed a little time to process and adapt to them. Just being laid back and taking things and evaluating and responding accordingly without overreacting, I think, is what I learned from my mom. For my dad, just hard work. I mean, my dad's a very hard worker. I spent many weekends fixing Mom's car on Saturdays and Sundays so that she had a car to drive on Monday, because we didn't have a lot of money to take it to the dealership or to get a new one.
And back then, we could fix our own cars, you know?
Well, he could. I could just hand him tools.
What was the first job you remember as a kid, and what did it teach you?
Oh, absolutely. Probably two-part first jobs. I learned very early on that if I wanted things, I needed to find a way to buy them myself. I couldn't just ask Mom and Dad. So I had a paper out with the Detroit News and helped get my little brother into that as well. So I had my route and I helped him with his. And then spent lots of time shoveling snow in the winter, cutting grass and raking leaves. So those were sort of those jobs, I believe, started for me all at the same time.
And what did those teach you?
They taught me that if you work hard, you get rewarded. And if you do just a little bit better than average, people recognize that and they'll pay a premium for that. So in both of those jobs, there was sort of a basic rate of pay expected, but tips was really where you made your money, certainly as a newspaper delivery person. So,
while in high school, you had a classmate who's done okay for himself by the name of Dan Gilbert.
Yeah, Dan and I did go to school together. We weren't classmates. Danny was a year behind me, we weren't the best of buddies or best pals, but we certainly knew each other. Trafficked sort of in the same circles, attended a lot of the same parties, and Danny certainly has done very well for himself. He's a proud Southfield Lathrop alumni, and I think what he's done for the city has been fabulous.
How has he done it, Greg?
I think he's had great vision. He's surrounded himself with a lot of great people that have also had great vision. And I think if you were to ask him, he's also been in the, you know, to some degree, been in the right place at the right time. There's been this big transformation with the what we've referred to as the millennial generation. They want to live in urban environments. They want to live in cities. And I think Danny had the vision to tap into that desire in people and also sort of married it with the concept of tapping into these millennials that want to be part of a rebuilding, a recreation. And so I think his messaging, I think it was just a fabulous idea to, which many people don't know, but they launched, Danny and Quicken launched an initiative to attract interns to the city each summer that I think has really been a big reason for the success with so many people wanting to live here in Detroit now. So it's just terrific.
Growing up in the Brightmoor District, were there any entrepreneurs around that you learned from?
None that were in our neighborhood. it's sad to say, Jack, I'm only aware of like one or two people from that neighborhood that are still alive today. That was a rough neighborhood, and I'm thankful that combination of God and my parents got me out of that neighborhood because as far as I know, most people that I grew up with either are dead or incarcerated. I don't really know that much about many of them. So there's one other family, the Van Antwerp family, that I am still friends with today that grew up in that neighborhood. Beyond that, I don't know a single soul from that era. So, we went to a church that was, coincidentally in Birmingham. So there were some entrepreneurs I looked up to there. A couple of guys, Nanowski, Joe, and Dan Nanowski. They actually are the brothers of Jim Nanowski, who played for the Cleveland Browns. They actually owned a Christian radio station that they sold later which I believe became WLLZ. So they had a number of businesses, so I always sort of looked up to and admired them. And then when I was in ninth grade, my dad branched off and started his own small consulting business, and so he was certainly an inspiration to me as well.
We're talking to Greg Packer. And when we come back, we're going to ask him how he ever got into the PEO sector. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and with Greg Packer. And from 85 to 1997, he was the founder and CEO of Amstaff, a PEO. Let's go to 1984, Greg. How was it you ever got into the PEO industry?
Well, that's as life typically throws it at you, things are interesting. So I was planning to go to graduate school, just sort of finishing up undergrad school at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. And my dad was approached by some guys that were studying this new business that was then called employee leasing. And he talked to me about it. It seemed interesting. So I went to the meeting with him. And just to shorten things up, I decided that I would invest a year in trying to see if I could create some sort of a sales opportunity for myself with that business. It was called Omnistaff. Unfortunately for me, 14 months later, they went belly up. And as a result, I was a pretty good salesman. But the clients that I had sold all lost money. Most of them lost about a month's worth of payroll. And as I went out to deliver the bad news, I was shocked because I expected to be yelled at, screamed at, thrown out of offices. But instead, pretty much everyone I talked to said, "We understand new industries struggle to get a foothold, and we sure do like the idea of not having to manage payroll and benefits and deal with workers' comp and all those kinds of things. So, can you find someone else that can do this?" So, I went over and visited with my mom, who had an accounting degree she'd never really put to work, and said, "Listen, I can sell what's in this brochure, Mom. In fact, I can sell it so well that people can lose a whole month's worth of payroll and benefits, and they want to do it again with me, even though I'm a 24-year-old kid." So at that point, I started Amstaff and began growing that company. And it was learned by trial and error. There wasn't an industry to compare to benchmark against. It was really new ground, just creating an industry sector here in Michigan.
A lot of people hear the term or the letters PEO, Professional Employer Organization. What is a PEO, Greg?
Well, the PEO, we adopted that terminology because the phrase employee leasing sounded far less palatable. I'm not sure that we hit on anything great with PEO either, but PEO, as you said, stands for Professional Employer Organization. And basically what we do, Jack, is we become the HR department for our clients on an off-site basis or an outsourced basis. So we handle all of the typical day-to-day payroll, benefit enrollment, benefit onboarding, new hire onboarding, 401k, all of the questions that in a large company, like a Ford or General Motors, would typically go to the HR department or would be dealt with by employee relations. We handle those things professionally for our smaller clients. Our average client's got about 25 employees. And so they typically don't have a professional resource in-house to handle those things for them.
So you're 24 years old, 1985, you start Amstaff. Describe for us the first corporate headquarters.
Well, the first corporate headquarters was a folding table where I shared a phone in my dad's consulting office, and I shared it with a gal named April, and fortunately, she didn't need to make a lot of calls, so I could steal her phone. It was the old phones where you had to press the button to grab a line, and I had two lines that came to me, and I just started marketing our concept, and pretty much between 9 and 5, Monday through Friday, I was talking to people who could make buying decisions, and outside of that, I was probably putting in another 100 hours a week developing marketing materials, sending letters. I would read the news and the free press, and that was the early days when Crane's Detroit Business started here in this market. So I would look for articles that could sort of make me feel like I knew a little bit about the business. If someone that seemed that they would be a good prospect or a good client for us, I'd send them a personalized letter, follow up with a phone call, and try to get an appointment.
Tell us about the 12-year chapter of Amstaff.
Well, we started like a lot of small businesses. It was, lots of hard work, and things went well. Back in the day, you have to remember, Jack, this is before fax machines, before computers, and we made the decision, the wrong decision. We made a decision to buy a networked word processing system instead of these new things called PCs, because we weren't sure, my mom and I, that they were going to catch on. So a lot of it was, we were constantly trying to become more efficient. And take care of our customers and answer the questions. Fortunately for us, the federal and state governments continuously pass laws to make the employment process more and more complex and more complicated and more risky for small business people. So they really created the market and the need for our services. So so we did that. We struggled along. We had to integrate with computers. I remember when the fax machine first came out, people might not recall, they were about $4,000 a piece. And I remember thinking, see, if every one of my clients could have one of these things, they could fax over their payroll information instead of having to call and have my mom have to write it down on a ledger sheet. And then fax machines dropped, and now they're obsolete. So we went through all those challenges, and then surprisingly, Wall Street discovered our industry and fell in love with it to a large degree. And I began looking at opportunities to potentially go public or to do other things to latch onto some additional capital, and finally settled on hitching my car to someone else's train and becoming part of the ADP family. And so I sold the business in 1997 and took a role as an executive with ADP to help create ADP Total Source.
What's the biggest things you learned in those 12 years?
I think probably the biggest thing is that if you take care of your customer, they'll take care of you by sticking with you. Ours is a business that it was then, it is now, that we earn our profits by having long-term relationships. We're not interested in short-term things. We'll take care of people on a short-term basis. That's in the PEO business. But we really need to have long relationships. That's, allows us to get into a grooved swing. And so that all starts with being honest, having integrity, and taking care of your customer.
I've talked to a lot of entrepreneurs for the years. I've been one. I don't know how successful I've been, but I've been one. And very few entrepreneurs, when they sell, can exist in this big corporate world of the acquiring firm. So you sell to ADP, huge. What was that transition like?
Yeah, I didn't care for it much. I was excited about the opportunity initially, and ADP is a phenomenal company. Actually, the guy who led the due diligence team is their CEO today, Carlos Rodriguez, and still a good friend, and I maintain a relationship, and I think the world of Carlos, and ADP couldn't have a better leader. But he's very much made for that world. I'm not. I sort of chafed at, you know, the reporting structure. I remember that was sort of all came together when we had some office equipment that broke down, and there was a whole requisition process. And I said, just go buy this stuff. Here's my credit card. And I pushed it through on my expense report, and all sorts of sirens and bells went off because you weren't supposed to put $25,000 worth of office equipment through on your expense account. But I just, you know, I was, you know, I enjoyed being in that smaller environment where, you know, we can make quick decisions and move on, and a big environment, big company environment does not play to my strengths.
Entrepreneurs, talk to us about entrepreneurs.
Well, entrepreneurs are our lifeblood. I would say that probably 75-80% of the clients that we serve are entrepreneurs, or, you know, second or third generation family businesses, where typically the leader that percolates to the surface is the one that has the most entrepreneurial expertise and tendencies. So I have the greatest degree of respect for entrepreneurs. They put it on the line every day. Going back to Dan Gilbert, I knew Dan when he started Rock Financial, his first business, and there was many iterations where he put it all on the line, and now it's very visible the success that he's had. But I think that too often people don't really understand, you know, they see successful entrepreneurs and they don't understand the road traveled to get there. It was filled with a lot of risk, taking a lot of chances, oftentimes, mortgaging homes, things like that to make it all work. So you just have to respect entrepreneurs.
Speaking of success, I've often heard that to entrepreneurs, success is the journey, not the destination.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think I've never really asked these questions. I know that for me, the focus is much, very much on the journey, you know, trying to make our business successful. You know, it's the thrill of building the business. Obviously, you hope there's a great reward at the end of that, and along the way. But it's, I know that for me, I didn't start out, like when I started my first business, I had no thoughts that I would ever sell it or sell it, one day. So that, it was the journey. It was just, every day getting up and enjoying what I was doing, building a business.
We're talking to Greg Packer. And in 2000, he helped found Access Point. When we come back, we'll ask him about that. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasul, and we're with Greg Packer. In 2000, he helped found Access Point. Why'd you do it again?
Well, after I had sold my business in 97 and did my stint with ADP, to be honest with you, Jack, I made a decision really to retire. I didn't think I was going to ever work in a traditional sense again. I had some very young kids. I was 38 years old. I had sort of lived the American dream. And I was really blessed to be able to spend a few years helping out with my kids. Those who I coached with for hockey will say I didn't have much knowledge to pass along, but I could move cones around and push pucks into the corner where the coaches who knew what they were talking about could then give instruction. So I got very involved with my four children and their sports activities. My wife took care of the rest of their requirements with education and things. But I was a coach or assistant coach for just about every team. All four kids did very well. All four of my kids ended up playing sports in college, either hockey or lacrosse. So that was a fun time early on to really get connected with them, get connected with their friends. But then, I invested in real estate. that was a point in time where here in Michigan, that was a way to sort of give back to the community, unfortunately. So that didn't go particularly well. Some of my former colleagues at my old business who were working at ADP were finding that they didn't love a big company any more than I had. And so ultimately, a guy named John Gillis, who had been our vice president of sales, convinced me that we should start a new business, Access Point. And so we did, and I partnered up with John and my father, Bill Manasco, who was retiring from Source One Mortgage Company at the time. He had some financial and IT background. So we decided to start Access Point.
Talk to us about building a team as an entrepreneur.
Well, that's what I enjoy most, is sort of building a team, you know, sort of identifying the needs, trying to match up, you know, the pieces of the puzzle. I remember sitting down at one of our very early discussions at that point in time, both my wife, Laura, and John's wife, Renee, were very much a part of us getting things started. And I remember saying to them, listen, we got to talk about building this team. So what are the jobs you like to do? I mean, there's no sense us bringing people in and they're going to, you know, leave you with the crummy jobs and they take the jobs that you like to do. Let's identify what you enjoy doing and find people to fill the other holes. So we began building that team. Fortunately for me, the second time around, number one, I had a bit of a roadmap from having done it before, but I also had a pool of 100 or so people that had worked for me previously that were in the office down the street at ADP, that many of whom... I'm proud to say wanted to join our team. So pretty much every time we identified a need, there was somebody over there that was, you know, willing, experienced, and we had a high level of familiarity with to add to our team. So today I think we have 21 or 22 people who worked with me at that old Amstaff business and have joined forces with us, and another couple of people that have been with us and since retired.
If you want to learn more, www.apteam.com.
That's correct.
No entrepreneur goes anywhere without great salespeople. The entrepreneur has the idea, the dream, but then we need salespeople to win the business and people to perform the business. Let's talk about great salespeople. What do they have in common?
I think tenacity. It's, you know, even the best salespeople typically have a success ratio well below the best, or even the lowest batting averages in Major League Baseball. And I think people, again, don't appreciate that. I remember a gal that worked with me who was at the time my assistant. She'd been one of our HR customer service people. And somebody called and was interested in our services. She said, I want to sell it myself, though. I don't want to get a salesperson involved. I want the commission. And I said, okay, well, we'll do that. And 15 meetings later, having made no progress, I said, you know, maybe we should get a salesperson involved. Because you have to sort of have the tenacity to apply the right and appropriate level of consistent pressure to move the deal along or to identify that it's not going anywhere. And it's not easy to, you know, a great salesperson might close 5-10% of the deals that they initiate. And so to get, you know, 9 no's for every 1 yes is not something that everybody's cut out to handle.
Speaking of tenacity, let's go back to 2007 and God gives us this economic tsunami. How'd you ever survive 2007 to 2010?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you, Jack. It was very tough, both personally and business. We, in several of those years, we measured our profits in single dollar increments, and you know, but we were always profitable. You know, we started, you know, reaching out to our clients because the economic downturn hurt us in some unusual ways because it actually complicated our work requirements. You know, when our client lays off employees, we handle the unemployment claims. We handle the extension of COBRA benefits and other things. Then the president extended that time frame, so we had to offer a new round of COBRA benefits. And so it really added to our workload at a time when our clients were getting smaller, and so paying us less for our services. We went out and talked to a few clients and tried to point this out and ask for some increases, and they said, well, gee, we we should probably look at what we're paying you now. We might be able to do this on our own. So we didn't do that anymore. So we just had to figure out a way to buckle down and get things done. And, you know, we survived. And then, you know, I started looking at how can we react to this, and also how can we prepare ourselves to be better suited to deal with it the next time around. So we started looking at diversifying both geographically and from an industry perspective. And actually during those years, we pivoted and expanded our footprint to create markets for ourselves in Western and Northern Michigan with offices in Grand Rapids and Traverse City. Towards the end of that time frame, we acquired a small business in Southwest Florida. And then ultimately we got into the staffing business, which led to us acquiring a staffing and recruiting company based in Lansing, Michigan called Advanced Employment.
Talk to us about the part culture plays in any successful business.
I think culture is key. You know, we have a our core values, which are visible throughout our offices, and you know, our core value is all around the word care. We care about each other, the people we work with. We care about our customers. We care about the communities we serve, and for us, you know, care is represented because we're committed, adaptable, resilient, and exceptional. And for us, that those core values are not things that I sat down with my leadership team and said, okay, we need to come up with some cool words to share with our people, and they need to become these things. It really was a reflection. We went through an exercise to identify what was the cultural core of our people already that made them great, that made us a good, successful company. And these words described that behavior that already existed. And so when we identify new people that we want to add to our team, when we look at a potential acquisition candidate, things of that nature, that culture is what is most important to us. So we were very fortunate when we acquired our staffing business, and then we acquired a healthcare IT business. They had almost identical core values already. They had not gone through the formal process of identifying them and labeling them. But really, the word care was tossed about as a differentiator by all three of those core groups. And so now we've walked away. We had an acquisition candidate we got very close to, and the ownership group would not allow us to meet face-to-face with the people and really get a chance to assess their core values. And we just said, we can't proceed.
If you want to learn more, www.APTeam.com. How does the leader go about propagating such a culture throughout the entire organization?
Well, as you grow, that gets harder and harder. So trying to communicate, we try to have, and I confess I'm not great at this, but again, to sort of to loop in Dan Gilbert, Dan has done a great job with his organization, and I've actually, you know, used some of the tools that he's developed. I don't know the exact particulars, but Dan has published a book of isms, which are the things that they talk about to help drive their culture. We don't have a book. I was just talking with a new business that's hopefully going to become a client of ours that you sort of to get to a certain mass of people to formalize some of those things. But what we do is I try to meet every person that we hire, the people who come into our corporate office, which is a little easier for me, I meet before we hire them. So I'm participating in every interview before we greenlight somebody to start. And then I have what we call CEO roundtables about once a month or so, where we bring in new people to meet in small groups. We typically have breakfast or coffee together and spend about an hour to 90 minutes talking about the history of the company, how important culture is, and how it's a reflection of what people are, and really to let them know that we aren't trying to change them, but that if they aren't these things, they aren't going to fit in, and it's not going to be me that's going to push them out the door. It's going to be their colleagues, because there's an expectation from our whole group of 140 or so people that that's how you go about taking care of customers.
We're talking to Greg Packer, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Greg Packer. Since 2002, he's been the chairman and CEO of Access Point. Over the past 5 years, Access Point has grown to nearly 500 clients, 85% based in Michigan, representing 7,500 employees, and the client sizes range from 2 employees up to 400, with the average client size being 25. Impressive.
Thank you.
Congratulations. You talked about a staffing division.
Yes.
What does that do?
Our staffing division does a lot of different things, but the the primary focus is we help identify the best candidates for our clients to fill their positions. So we have a direct hire division, which is sort of your typical headhunting role, typically for higher level positions above, say, $50,000 or $60,000 a year. But our sort of the meat and potatoes is that we become a staffing arm, which actually that, you know, clients with 400 employees, we have many clients that, that exceed that for our staffing group. We work with American Axle, American Mitsubishi, Magna Corporation, University of Michigan, Michigan State, to become their recruiting arm. And typically what we do there, Jack, is we will really become an extension of the company. So there's a facility in Battle Creek where there's, I think, 300 or 400 people that work there, and every single person there except the original plant manager, we recruited and placed there. So the hourly manufacturing type workers, will recruit them. They are on our payroll for 4 or 5 months, sort of giving the client opportunity to get to know them, and then they transition into their long-term staff. We also do some other interesting things. Our staffing group is very adaptable and resilient, two of our core principles, and so we are the largest provider of road flaggers, which is sort of a unique thing that I think is interesting. The official title is traffic regulators, and there's a certification process, and we equip these teams and send them out. So be kind to those folks on the side of the road. Most of them are access point folks, and you know the traditional stop slow sign. We equip them with radios, hard hats, tell them how to dress properly with proper footwear, and then we dispatch them. We have a dispatcher that works during the construction season. So we have several hundred of those folks that are out on any given day. So we like sunshine, because when the sun is shining, the roads are being built and our folks are working.
You and Laura have been very blessed, and you've given back. And one of your special causes have been Vehicles for Change.
That's right. Vehicles for Change is a terrific program that I'm proud to be the chairman of the local board. I also sit on the national board. Our good friend, yours and mine, Jack, Lou Perez, was very instrumental when he was the CFO for the Detroit Lions. They were very generous with their support to bring Vehicles for Change, which was operational in Baltimore, where Lou had a connection, to Detroit. And what we do with Vehicles for Change is we collect cars, get donated cars, and we fix them up and repurpose them. We're the only program, really, in the country that takes cars for this purpose and repurposes them to low-income families. We work with Matrix Group, Southwest Solutions, the United Way, many other charities here in the Detroit area. They identify candidates, and the cars are awarded. We don't give them to them. They pay $75 a month for 12 months, so $900 to get a car that's typically worth $4,000 to $5,000 once we fixed it up. We give them a 6-month warranty, and the primary criteria that what's standing between them and a better job or a job is not having their own reliable transportation. We also have developed a program that to fix these cars. We have a garage, an auto repair shop, and we use that as a training facility to train primarily ex-offenders. About 75% of our students are ex-offenders, and we graduate these students. They get paid about $10 an hour while they're in the program training. And when they graduate, they're typically getting jobs in the $20 to $22 an hour range. And I'm very proud to say that we have our first graduate, not from the Detroit school, but from our Baltimore school, that made $100,000 this year, or will make $100,000 this year based on his W-2. So it's pretty great to take somebody who was incarcerated 4 years ago, and now they're making six figures as an auto mechanic.
26% of the households in Detroit don't have an automobile, so you're helping them. You mentioned our good friend Lou Perez. A year ago, you hired him. Huge. A lot of entrepreneurs, Greg, can't let the reins go to somebody else. Why did you hire Lou, and why did you turn over the reins to him?
Well, as I told Lou, and I think I've told you, Jack, I was fortunate early in my career to cross paths with Tom Monahan, and I asked him the question. This is when he, I believe, still owned Domino's the first time around. And the question was, you know, what would you say is the one thing that you've done consistently to lead to your success? And the answer was, when I find a good person, I hire them, and then I figure out what to do with them. And it's never served me wrong. And so when I met Lou, he was one of the first people I really felt that way about, but he was gainfully employed with the Detroit Lions. And then for a variety of reasons, he left there. And I tried to lure him in at that point, and I lost him to the Detroit Pistons. And then he became available again, and I was very fortunate to bring him in. It has been hard, and I will say that, you know, the one question or the one ask that Lou had when we began those conversations, or when we concluded them, really, was that that we would have disagreements, and that if we disagreed on business things, that I had to agree to let him win those arguments. And thankfully, we haven't had any disagreements. We've been very much in lockstep. And I'm thrilled with the role Lou is playing. He's when we talked, I said, you know, I don't want to be a small business anymore. I want to be a big business. So I need somebody who knows what a big business looks like from the inside. And there aren't many businesses bigger than the NFL. So Lou brings that perspective. He also has a background with KPMG. So he's definitely helping us on that journey. And our journey now is to be a 100-year-old business. And Lou has very much embraced that. And so we're well on our way.
As our time winds down together this evening, what advice did he give to our young listeners?
I think, you know, for this generation, you know, again, referred to as millennials, I think having a willingness to do just a little more than average really sets people apart. I learned from a guy that worked for my dad many years ago named Jerry Diddle. He said, you just got to be willing to be a little bit better than average. And that really stands out. I think that, you know, a lot of the millennials, they really value their personal time, their workout time, their outdoor time. But it's hard to set yourself apart if you're, you know, out the door at 4:59 every day. You know, just being willing to do a little bit more than average really will cause you to stand out and make an impression. And then, you know, be honest and true to yourself. And also, I think, recognize that you know, I think that in the schools today, we're constantly telling these kids, you know, pursue a career you love. It might not be your first career, so work hard at all of them until you find that one that's the perfect match.
Greg Pecker, what a shining example of a true entrepreneur. Keep up the great work.
Thanks, Jack.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoken.
Believe in yourself.